Last week, we really talked almost exclusively about EFL, but I talked about it in the context, at least that's what I believe I did, maybe you all think I did something else, in the context of meditation and our teachings. This week I thought I'd just start right in with, do it the other way around, just really like start in with meditation and then show how that relates to how we're educating our kids. Does that make sense? But before I do that, does anybody have any questions or thoughts or comments from our last conversation?
I was deeply inspired by class week.
Good.
I like knowing the history of the school. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
And I didn't have that completeness.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, very good.
Is there anything pertinent that I missed? Sorry, Dan.
Oh well, actually, we recorded the whole class, and it was my expectation that it would be available, but it didn't get posted. So we'll post last week and this week tomorrow. I was saying to Jack, I'm used to just literally walking out of the room, and then the next day it's posted because all the other people take care of it. But Eric wasn't quite in the flow, so we're going to get Dunbar to do it. Thank you very much.
I don't know if the cord was going to reach me.
Sooner or later I would pick them up. Okay. So any other thoughts? Or what was it? You liked it just being informed?
Yeah. It was important to know. Well, I had not known the actual history of where and your involvement in the school.
Oh, this
and
school,
and just how that started and how it came to be. And then I didn't realize that there was the larger goal of really Satchitananda that is the over mission almost.
Oh, that is the mission, that's the whole point.
And I had no idea. But I mean, I guess some part of me knew that, but just to actually know that that is what's up top and trickling down and, you know, everything kind of builds off that. It's nice to know.
I'm glad that worked. I thought that was interesting, too. As you see, I teach without notes, so I just sort of figure it out as I go. You know, just to be fair about the history of the school. Hello, Joylynn. I have to put my husband David in there, too, because he has the financial acumen that I don't know if I have it because I've never had to develop it because I've only worked as in partnership. But he put it together financially and held it together financially. And so all those years when I was also completely engaged, so was he. He ran everything to do with the money and scholarship. We were just talking a little about the history of the school. So it was really a joint effort on our part. He gets forgotten because I make so much noise and he doesn't. But he would never have gotten off the ground, ever, because he just has that touch. You know, he knows how to make, he knows how to build something from nothing and have it not go bankrupt, which is a really good thing to do. So, plus we backed it with, you know, the money from Ananda. There was no school fund. It all came out of the, just as it has now. I mean, this whole building here, $1.5 million, just came out of, you know, that building came out of that building. That's how it was put together. What this building wasn't built by school parents by any means. It was built by people who have no children, for the most part, or no children in the school, or very few, who have built it for the purpose of Yogananda's intention to create a better society on every level, and education being a really important part of that. And so I and we act, and you know, most of the teachers in the school are acting from that impetus, which is what gives the school, not all of the teachers have it as personally as some do, but it's what gives it sort of an extra level of commitment. Because people feel that they're not just doing something that will last as long as they're alive, but we're setting a direction that I think in time will really catch on. One of the things that Swami Kriyananda says in that Education for Life, schools reflect what the parents want. And I've been involved in this kind of alternative life, you might say, for so many years now that I've watched society catch up. I've watched starting so far at the edge that people, we really, and with pride, would call ourselves the lunatic fringe, but I have watched society move right into where we were standing. And without ever, and the most interesting thing is, without there ever being any government involvement. I mean, I think of organic foods as a very, organic foods, vegetarianism, health food, yoga practice, and meditation are all the things that I started doing in like 1966, 67. And it was, you know, my relatives thought I was going to die when I stopped eating meat. And literally, I had to submit my entire diet, which was given to a doctor, pronounced it the healthiest diet he'd ever seen, and predicted I would live to be 150. You know? But it was so radical at that point. But there's just been a shift in consciousness, and now people just think like that, and they don't even, it doesn't even cross their mind that it's odd. But I watched it. And I believe that the same is going to happen in the next probably 20 years. I thought it would happen sooner. It's happening slower than I thought. But in the next 20 years or so, I think that education's going to just shift over. It's beginning, charter schools, you know, alternatives. People are, children are rebelling, parents are getting suspicious. It's begun to shift. And my understanding of the role of great spiritual leaders is they disseminate ideas that are not necessarily always associated with their name, but it's a point of view. And so what Yogananda has brought is a point of view about the purpose and meaning of life. And his first work when he was a young man in India was to start a school. And his first work in America, he started a school. But he couldn't get it off the ground because there weren't enough parents who were in tune with what his educational ideals. So he gave up and decided he had to train the parents first. And then after he died, it became the time where we could start what we're doing now. And the interesting thing, and just to finish, because you brought it up like that, it doesn't really matter whether or not you have the relationship to the founding inspiration for this school that I and a few of us have, because the school stands on its own. And the fruit of it is the things we were talking about last week, and some of you were responding to, the capacity to work with children in a certain way comes from all that's behind it. Reading Education for Life, again, as I've been doing for the purpose of discussing with y'all, it's very interesting to me. Because Swamiji never actually lays out the philosophical foundation behind that book. He just sort of gives you the idea of how education could be. And what I've been doing here is backing up. And I realize that's one of the reasons why the book is communicates and inspires, but doesn't quite, because there's the whole premise upon which it's based, which is what I was saying yesterday, which is why it holds water. But he wanted it to be popular. He didn't want people to have, that's why he even used his American name, you know, Donald Walters, so that it wouldn't seem like some far out culty kind of thing, because it isn't, it's just ideas that he references. But nonetheless, it all begins to make more sense when you, and he leaves it, his way of writing has never been to back you into a corner. His way of writing has always been to give you directions and then let you figure it out for yourself. If as many people believe there is meaning to life, therefore. But he doesn't try to tell you what that meaning is. He just tells you that if these things are true, then these other things will be true, and then you have to sort that out for yourself. It gives you a lot more freedom. Plus, it's seminal writing, and therefore it leaves a lot of space for others to go from it into other things. Well, having said all that, I was going to start with meditation. So shall we tonight? Okay. I think that we'll start with, let me just think how to do this. Let me try to think for a minute. I think I'll chant a little bit. We'll do a guided meditation. A few minutes of silence, and then I'm going to really lay a deeper foundation for what meditation is and how we should do it. But let's just have a little bit of experience just to begin. In the way that we meditate, I mean, I'm sitting here in front of pictures of masters on the altar, so self-evidently this is a path that involves relationship. Relationship to guru and relationship to God. Relationship to a higher reality. It's not just my stilling my own mind and sitting in it. which some paths are, they use the phrase, I heard the Dalai Lama use this, so I really shouldn't denigrate it, but it bewildered me. Non-deistic spirituality. I find that a little oxymoronic in my own mind, but nonetheless, that's what people are doing, because I think you have to have some place to go. And I think it's nicer if there's a conscious being on the other side of that. But that's why I'm on this path and not on his. So there you have it. Everybody has a different way. So having said that, whenever we are with the children and whenever we're in a group of adults together, we always start by praying. And the prayer is meant to invoke the presence of the masters, to consciously bring them to our remembrance and into our aura. It's also, as I'll explain as we progress, not all tonight. It's a way of building those relationships, because relationships become, just as in life, as in spiritual life, relationships are everything. So we invoke the aspects of the divine and then this particular line of masters, which tonight I will name them all. And the aspects of the divine are all the relationships we can have. Father, mother, friend, beloved. So that's how we'll pray. And we usually pray responsively, if you don't mind repeating after me. Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Friend, beloved God.
Friend, beloved God.
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
Babaji Krishna.
Babaji Krishna.
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Paramhansa Yogananda.
Paramhansa Yogananda.
Saints of all religions.
Saints of all religions.
Humbly we bow to you all.
Humbly we bow to you all.
And with the children we always say, Divine Spirit within me.
Divine Spirit within me.
Help us to attune ourselves.
Help us to attune ourselves.
To our own higher wisdom.
To our own higher wisdom.
That we may be guided.
That we may be guided.
In just the right way.
In just the right way.
To a deeper understanding.
To a deeper understanding.
Of our own next step.
Of our own next step.
In expanding awareness.
In expanding awareness.
In greater joy.
In greater joy.
In greater service to all.
In greater service to all.
Om. Peace. Amen.
Amen.
I'm going to read a very simple chant. It's listen, listen, listen. To my heart's song, I will never forget thee, I will never forsake thee. I like this song, this chant particularly because it's simple, and also because it exists on many levels of meaning. You can just be, it can be just an affirmation for yourself. You know, listen to my own heart feeling, let me always be in tune with that, let me never forget that, and never turn away from it. It can also be a prayer, saying to the divine, you know, listen to what my heart is saying. Don't pay attention to all the other things I do. Just listen to my intention. And then we make that vow, I will always be loyal to the highest truth. However you want to do it. Chanting, the chants we do are just literally affirmations set to music. So if you want to join me, please do, or otherwise just tune in.
Listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never.
listen, listen, listen to my heart song. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. So now sit comfortably upright. In whatever way you can, we'll work all this out much more later. Lift your eyes just above the horizon line and feel that you are looking out from your eyes to a point just above the horizon line as if there was a window in front of you. It's just a little higher than your eyes, so you have to look up a little to look through it. And when you look through it, you see a beautiful snow-capped mountain out there, covered with that luminous white snow that looks almost blue. And the sun is setting behind us so that the rays of the sun are touching that snow and making it shine with golden light. So the white, the luminous blue, and the gold all come together in this snow-capped peak that we have to look just slightly up to see. Now feel ourselves not merely looking at that peak, but in a very real sense expanding out from where we stand or where we sit. Just reaching out with our energy, our appreciation, our love of the beauty of it. Because of the luminous quality of the light on that mountain, it seems responsive to our appreciation of it. It glistens back, and the rays of its light reflect back into us. So we are both reaching out with our vision and our feeling of appreciation, and also receiving back reflected rays of white, luminous blue and gold. Now feel as your breath comes in, your inhalation, you're taking in that luminous light. And as your breath goes out, you're offering back appreciation for the beauty and for the gift of that light. Don't worry about controlling the breath, just try to be conscious. When you inhale, the light comes into you. When you exhale, you give gratitude and appreciation for that beautiful light. Receive and give. Receive and give. We can add to that flow a thought that will help to keep us focused. As we receive the light on the inhalation, we can say simply, inwardly, not out loud, I am. The light's coming into you. I am. And as we exhale, we can say, light. I am light. I am light. Don't be concerned about everything else that's going on in your mind at the same time. Just breathe in, I am, receive, give back light. Let's just practice that for a few minutes here. Nice introduction, seemingly. Any questions about what that little practice we just did?
Something deeper to it that you can explain?
Oh, yes. And,
so
I and I will. And I will.
I have a question, too. Uh-huh. I felt very difficult to maintain an image from you.
Sure. It's not necessary to maintain an image. Some people are visual and some are not. So I... myself, I am more feeling-oriented than visual. But if I start with an image, what I draw from that image is the feeling of the image. And then I don't really care whether I'm looking at it anymore, but I know what it's supposed to feel like.
Yes, that's what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And some people just get the picture right immediately, but it's hard. When you add a picture to a feeling, then the aspiration that a high mountain peak would offer gives you a feeling of what we're trying to do. We're going beyond where we're sitting. But yes, you're right. It doesn't, not everything works for everyone. As we go through, just by the way, I think you actually have my company for the entire 6 weeks because it's not really practical for Gary or Helen. And in fact, the truth is that was a misunderstanding. They never intended to do it. It was always just me. I thought I would wait till the second class to tell you that. Hopefully that you won't find that too disappointing. But you'll just all be here this whole time. But in the course of teaching, more about meditation, which we're starting now, I'll tell you things that are essentially the way Yogananda suggested we do it, and other things which are just these you can just mix and match in lots of directions. Everything that I teach you about meditation is what I myself have been practicing, but I didn't make any of this up. As I was talking about last week, there's a truth to the way we're made, and these masters and any true spiritual teacher is not guessing. He's perceiving because of his own state of consciousness. He's perceiving the way things are. If you start learning to play the guitar, you can kind of guess about how you want to hold your hands and things like that. And you might find that it works a certain way, but somebody who knows the whole scope of becoming a really good guitar player is going to tell you that you have to start like this. Because as you get more advanced with it, this is what you're going to need to be able to do. So sometimes when people just make up meditation, they'll do something that works in the context that they're sitting in, but won't understand that it's going to be a cul-de-sac unless they go down certain roads. Mm-hmm. Visualization is very beneficial for some people, but you don't have to be able to visualize. To relate to the breath is a fundamental aspect of meditation. You have to relate to the breath sooner or later for reasons that I'll explain. You can relate to it from many different angles, but you have to relate to the breath. Because breath is the key to shifting consciousness. And I'll talk about that. Any other questions or thoughts about that? I was really just trying to dip us into it without trying to do more. Last week I talked about Satchitananda as being the best explanation of where we're actually going. What I'm going to talk about now, and again, I want to emphasize, these are things that I have absorbed and come to believe, but I didn't make them up. This was Yogananda's revelation, the way he explained things for Americans, from the very ancient teaching of India, but brought it to America. His mission in life was to take the Indian teaching and bring it to America. It's not Hinduism at all. It's what's called Sanatan Dharma. I don't like to use a lot of foreign words, but sometimes you have to. Sanatana Dharma means simply that which is, or it means the eternal religion. And all true religions, are Sanatana Dharma. They start with the facts of who we are and how we are related to higher consciousness and how we get from being trapped in the ego to being free in the spirit. Spiritual teaching that does not conform to the principles of Sanatana Dharma cannot honestly be considered a true religion. But all the main religions of the world, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, not as they're necessarily practiced now, but as their founding masters brought them, conformed to Sanatana Dharma. I grew up Jewish, and if you're a Jew, you just don't hang around where there's a picture of Jesus. It's a really, really, really big deal for Jewish people. It wasn't such a big deal for me, but, you know, 10% of Ananda is Jewish, which is much higher than the national average, because I think Jews are trained to think outside the box. But all of them have had to go through the question of Jesus. But what Sanatana Dharma is what saves you. Christianity is not the teaching of Jesus. Christianity is what people of lesser consciousness did with it later. What Jesus taught was Sanatana Dharma. He taught exactly what we teach here. He taught the way we're made, where our happiness comes from, how to draw closer to that happiness. Everything in life is about avoiding suffering and increasing bliss. Every single decision that we make, no matter how stupid it turns out to be, at the time we thought it was a good idea. I mean, if you think about it, you become very sympathetic towards yourself and others. Because at the time it seemed like a good idea, otherwise you wouldn't have done it. You know, that's what we watch our little children do. It seems like a good idea. I don't like what he's doing to me. I'm going to pick up this truck and I'm going to just hit him over the head. And at the time, it seems like a good idea. And then gradually you have to educate them that that is really not going to bring you what you want over a long cycle. And we're not a lot different. You know, we do it, we manifest it differently. But we're doing things that are the equivalent of that, thinking that it's going to make us happy. So Sanatana Dharma is simply how to avoid suffering, how to increase happiness. Now, the thing about Sanatana Dharma, or any true spiritual path, is that it is not concerned only, or even primarily, with what you do, your visible actions in the external world. Your visible actions in the external world are an indication of who you are. But there is a who you are that goes behind your visible actions. You know, because everything in this world starts as a thought, then we apply energy to it, then it finally manifests. And when we're trying to, I was talking about the building over there, you can see it in simple terms. We had the idea there was this old rat-infested house over there that was like from 1910, and it was about to be declared an historical relic, and we would never have been able to tear it down. So we had to tear it down and build something else there, else we would have been stuck with that rat-infested falling down house for the rest of our lives. So we had the idea that we needed to tear it down and we wanted to build a building. We engaged an architect and we worked with him to get a blueprint for that, but still there's no building. Then we followed that blueprint and created the building. But none of it would have started if we hadn't gone back to the level of thought, the non-material. When the child picks up the truck and whacks the other kid with the truck, there's a thought that something is, I'm having an experience of consciousness. And that experience of consciousness then manifests as an idea, I don't like what's happening. Then the thought comes that I don't like what's happening because he is a problem. Then the idea comes, I will pick up this truck. And then pretty soon you've whacked the kid. But it never would have happened if there hadn't been an experience of consciousness back here somewhere that was, that demanded action, you see? And if the child is, like all of your children are, I'm certain, completely at peace with himself and thinks only peaceable thoughts toward everyone else, and he sees that, oh, my little friend wants the truck more than I. Oh, bless him, let him have it. You know? Then his action would be completely calm because there would be no agitation in his consciousness that would lead to a thought that would lead to an action.
That line of thinking, what about things that feel like habits that are automated or feel like routines that don't seem to arise from a thought in that moment?
That, right. Because if you repeat something over and over again, you become oriented in that direction. So as soon as any kind of a impulse arises before you actually have any control over your reaction. Your reaction is determined. I think of it like this. It isn't exactly true, but if the floor is tilted like that,
mm-hmm.
and the marble of consciousness has a reaction here, it will simply roll down
mm-hmm.
where it's okay. And it rolls down this way because you have dug a trench that way.
Right.
And you've dug that trench by, well, for many things. You know, last week you spoke of the way you were raised, and we're talking about children, so you're raising your children in a certain way. You also have reincarnation, but I'll throw that in a moment. You develop these habits of, this is how I respond to things, and then you become oriented toward that. The more you repeat it, the more you become oriented toward it, the more you become oriented to it, the less capable you are even of realizing that the marble has rolled.
Mm-hmm.
Because the marble always rolls that way, and you don't even have a connection anymore about choice. This is why education for life is such a lifesaver for children. Because most of us grew up without anybody ever talking to us about the mechanism of what we were building by our everyday responses, because very few or no teachers that were teaching us had any idea. They taught us to do our math, they taught us to do our this, and they forced us to behave. So we learned to discipline ourselves, but we didn't necessarily learn to understand what we were responding to, or why we were responding, or what motivated us, or whether we had a choice. Last week we talked about rocks in the basket, choosing happiness, practicing kindness, as teaching the children to observe positive realities, to become oriented toward observing positive realities, so the habit of their mind is to see the positive. They're always noticing, because people can go through life and never notice the good things that are happening because they're so self-concerned, or they have been trained by the people around them to only notice the negative, to always be anxious. We're trying to orient the children toward having a positive view of life, to emphasizing the good, so that their natural orientation will be to think that everything is going well, or that I can change the situation by putting out my own good, positive energy. You see what an enormous, just for exactly the reason you said, there's many more, and I'll progress as we go through this since we have time. I can talk about this on much more subtle levels that really will give you a picture of how this works. But it all comes down to, the more energy you put in a particular direction, the deeper the groove gets, and then habit follows. But the good news about that is, there's nothing fixed about it. There's no physical reality to your habits. They are a pattern of energy that has been created by repetition that can be shifted by applying as much energy to the new habit as you apply to the old habit. For most people, to apply as much energy to the new habit takes time, but it doesn't have to take time. It's the question of how much energy you put. Most people, it takes time for them to put out a lot of energy, but it doesn't have to. You can make a strong determination in 1 minute and then just reverse habits of a lifetime if you can bring enough energy to bear on. Because there's nothing fixed. It's just energy to energy.
No matter how deep that neural pathway is?
No matter. It's because it's not... The neural pathway is formed by something more subtle, which is the state of your consciousness. Yeah. Well, what is it... It's true that the consciousness eventually becomes matter. The idea of a building eventually becomes a building. The idea of our consciousness eventually becomes a physical body. This physical body is the manifestation of all of the habits of energy. And this gets us into the much more esoteric parts of it, which we will go there. But I don't think I won't quite go there tonight. I'll do something else.
Love that.
Pardon me?
I'd love that.
I love it too. I adore it. But I can't do everything tonight. We'll touch it. Okay. But ask as many questions as you like, because we can get to where we're going by 1,000 roads. And your questions are the best roads to get there. Our consciousness, essentially, and we've touched on this, consists of three elements. And I don't use these words exactly as... never decide which way to do it. Exactly as they're used in modern psychology, especially not the word subconscious, but it's related. There's three fields of energy that we are always working with. Subconscious, conscious, and superconscious. Our society and our psychological study and so on is works a lot with the subconscious. That's what modern psychology is mostly about. They have a much less clear idea of the superconscious, even though the people try to find it. Let's see. The subconscious, the way I'm talking about it, is everything that is past, is already done. Okay. The subconscious is not the source of anything new. The subconscious for us is the accumulated effect of every thought, every action, every feeling, every desire we've had, not only in this incarnation, but in all the incarnations that came before. It is why the marble just rolls, and you can't even think about it. If you've been a strong warrior for many incarnations, if something challenges you, you have a tendency to fight like that. If you've been a weak, small, sort of female person, and you know, sort of gotten in the habit of being subservient, then when people come at you, you shrink down into that, because your subconscious inclinations, this is who we have always been. This is who we have always been. There's another way to say this. This is who we've always been, and the superconscious is what we can become. I called it last week Satchidananda. And there's always this struggle going on between what we have always been and what we can become. And the conscious mind, the conscious level of reality, is not a thing in itself. It's the battleground between these two forces. Okay? And if you think about your life, we realize that we're always on this battleground of, I got on the scale this morning. I'm talking about literally about myself. My body is bigger than it has ever been in its life. It's by no means huge, but it's bigger than it's ever been, and the question is, when will this ever stop? Okay? So today, I did not eat toast. I thought a lot about toast most of the day, but I didn't eat toast. My conscious mind was the battleground between my habit of eating toast and my desire not to just simply expand into infinity in ways that I don't wish to expand. That was the battleground for me. Early this morning, when I get up, the fight always in my conscious mind is, do I meditate before I check my emails or after I check my emails? You know? And the conscious mind is the battleground between those things. I'm sure you can make a list for yourself. It doesn't always have to be dramatic, but we're always being influenced from two sides. The expanded side towards superconsciousness, the habit of whom we've always been. There is an attractiveness to just going with the known. There's an attractiveness because it is familiar. And people have what I call a preference for the known misery. It's not like it's really satisfying, but it's familiar. And many of us prefer the known misery even to the possibility of something better, but this is familiar. Also, to go with the subconscious takes less energy. It's just as simple as that, because it's the way that we're oriented and we can just roll down there. We know how to do this.
The default.
It's the default setting, that's a good word for it, and we just go that direction. To expand into something new, also by very definition, superconscious is a higher level of energy than subconscious. But you can never be at peace. You can never just sink into subconsciousness forever, because we are made of both elements. The and even more true, the superconscious is our inevitable destiny. Because the subconscious persuades us that the less energy we put out, the better we'll feel. But that's a lie. Because true satisfaction always comes when we reach for something more, expand our awareness, this is what we talked about last week, and come closer to what our true nature is, which is Satchidananda. The children, it's just the same. I want to remain a little baby. I want to have my way. I want to have my tantrum. I want to blame the other children. I don't want to learn to read. Math is too difficult. You know, I want to stay where I am and put out less energy. At the same time, they themselves are being impelled by the superconscious, because it has it's the river seeking the ocean. That's the actual word for it. You know, we are made, and this is what I said last week, what is the meaning of life? we are the river seeking the sea. And even though we may puddle on the meadow for a long time and just sit there, you know, the ocean is always going to be calling us. This is part of Sanatana Dharma. If we watch ourselves, we'll notice this. We try to go into subconsciousness and we just stay there. As someone said once, it's not that easy to lie down and die. You might decide you're going to lie down and die, but you usually get hungry. You know, something happens. We try to become completely unconscious. We try to overeat. We try to drink. We try to take drugs. We try to do nothing but watch television. We try to never relate to our emotions. You know, all the different ways that we try to sink into a lower level of reality. We can spend lifetimes there, or big parts of lifetimes there. But sooner or later, it just doesn't make us happy. At some point, the known misery is so miserable that we're willing to risk the unknown joy. And nobody, not one human being, ever changes until the known misery is unbearable. And it doesn't have to be unbearable in a hugely dramatic way. It can be just quietly unbearable. You know, I mean, I've talked to many of you in different contexts. You want something more. That's why you're here. And still there is this conflict going on. With our children, this is what we're working with constantly. We're trying to draw them into their own higher potential. The natural resistance, you know, very few children are, and later in the book it talks about light versus heavy consciousness. Light consciousness wants to expand. Heavy consciousness wants to stay as it is, or even to plunge deeper into the mire. Okay? Now, the other characteristics of subconscious and superconscious is that subconscious is entirely its own reality. It does not connect to a broader reality. Think of it like this. Subconsciousness is sleep. And when you're asleep, you can have dreams. And you can dream about the person who's sleeping in the bed next to you. But they don't have the same dream. It's not their reality. You can be having a nightmare that they were killed and they're just perfectly, happily sleeping next to you. And dreams are the most dramatic example of this, but much subconscious reality happens when your eyes are open, but it happens like this. Why did you look at me like that? I didn't look at you like that. Yes, you did. Yes, you did. I know you don't like me. I liked you perfectly well. No, you don't. I've always felt you hated me. We get caught up in our own definition of reality, and we think that it's actually real. People, this is where madness comes from. People who become, you know, irreparably depressed or schizophrenic or hallucinatory, or just, you know, you see people wandering on the streets talking. There was this homeless man who used to sit and he had all these papers and he was always doing his important work. You know, he must have, in some part, some life, part of this life, he must have actually done that sort of thing. But now he was just in a world of his complete creation. And there was no reality to the world he was living in. So the other aspect that makes subconscious what it is it's the opposite of the goal of education for life, which is true maturity, which is the ability to relate appropriately to realities other than just your own. So not only is the goal of life in general to come out of subconsciousness into superconsciousness, but it is the definition of true maturity. Because the more our lives are only defined by what we ourselves know, the more literally immature we are. That's why your child will throw himself on the floor and have an absolute tantrum about something. Just absolutely determined that if I get upset enough, then somehow the world's going to conform. My sister, who was a very good mother to a very hard-to-raise son, you know, he would just sometimes, he's 23 now, I think. I believe in his last lifetime, he was an attorney from New York City. And he was born, like, as soon as he could talk, he could argue. And he could argue really well, too, and he would often argue. He would always argue. But I remember once her just looking at him, once that I witnessed, and she said, "Do I ever change my mind when I speak to you like this? Think if I have ever changed my mind." He said, "No." She said, I'm not going to start now. Meaning that he was trying to impose upon her his subconscious reality. She was not going to take it. She was saying to him, you will relate to what I'm telling you because it's for your own good and you're going to do it. And of course, he did at that point. You know, a lot of the interplay with children is that they want to insist on their own reality, and you have to keep bringing them into relation to a greater reality. I'm sorry, dear, you do have to relate to it. You can't just not. You can't just not relate to what I'm telling you to do. You can't just not relate to the other members of this family. You can't just not relate to the other kids in your class. You have to grow into greater maturity, which is the ability to relate to reality other than your own. And subconsciousness, by definition, is always immature because it's caught in its own reality.
So is it the case then that when you say that our superconsciousness is weird, predisposed towards expanding, that is in sort of in community, because you have to know other people's maturity. In other words, it's not as if, okay, I'm ascending myself, but it's through others that I expand my awareness and other people's awareness. I guess I'm trying to understand the relationship between maturity and this expansive notion.
Maturity is the ability to relate to realities other than one's own. So
mm-hmm.
therefore, by definition, you would have to either have the intuitive perception or learn through experience. The truth is, the way the Ananda path works, you know, every path is different, is ours is a perfect balance of both.
I see.
And I'm coming into the concept of meditation. Meditation is inward expansion, but then community is taking that inward understanding and applying it to real life, to everyday life. And the ideal balance is that you can do both. The actual fact is, it's stages of spiritual development. It's defined in certain books, but for the first three of the five stages, you must be interacting with other people because you're simply not clear-minded enough to know without external feedback. You can reach the stage of spiritual maturity where you can be a hermit and still continue to expand, and still, in truth, without ever actually being with anyone, to be in connection with everyone's reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the nature of superconsciousness, if I will. Whereas subconsciousness is entirely self-declared. And, you know, and people who live a lot in subconsciousness, even if their eyes are open and they're very energetic, often have a lot of conflict with people. Because they're always having an experience that nobody else is having. You know? I mean this in the sense of either that you're a little out of your mind, or you're so caught in your emotional perception of reality that you are always declaring things that nobody else is experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Early on in my marriage, I used to be a lot more difficult than I am now. I think. I said once to my husband, how much time do you spend just like working around my emotions? And he smiled at me and said, you don't want to know, you really don't want to know. You know, just the man just having to adjust to the fact that I was always tripping off into something that was just going on for me. And that he would have to, you know, take it seriously because I seemed to think it was real. His other fabulous one was, everything is fine and then you get upset. Which I didn't think was so funny at the time. Now I think it's very funny. Because actually everything was fine and then I got upset. I drifted into this reality of mind and insisted I could not relate appropriately to his reality. I would project upon him realities that were not his. So things were fine and then I would get upset. And it took me a while to figure that one out, but I did. Okay, so let me just go a little bit. When we get to the conscious level, reality is still more shared. I will just sort of ignore that for the moment. We're having a marriage moment off to the right, but we're just going to let it go.
This is generally where everyone is functioning, yeah? Well, I guess females, yeah, a big part. But there's like what you were just explaining is like, you know, everyone that I know.
Most of the people in the world, we're not, yeah, this path. The whole idea of Sanatana Dharma, the whole idea of Satchitananda, the whole idea of education for life is not a mass movement yet. You know, it is not popular culture. You will not see it on the billboards. It's just not there yet. I mean, people are just, in fact, You know, people in the point of view of marriage, people are pushed toward the subconscious. You know, declare your own reality, set your boundaries, do what you want. You know, it's the opposite of true maturity. It's the opposite of trying to figure out what other people's realities are and relating to them. It's to affirm your own. I mean, if you have no self at all, it's better to have a selfish self than no self. But it's progressive. Everything's directional. I mean, if you were raised by an alcoholic parent, for example, and never, ever, ever even knew anything about yourself and had it all taken away from you, become a solidly selfish person. That would be a step forward. But we're going to assume a certain level of health and then go from there. So on the conscious level, it's a much greater level of shared reality. We're all sitting in this room together. If tomorrow morning we had a discussion about what happened here, there would be many, many, many places where we would overlap. We would generally know what the room looked like. You would probably remember I was wearing blue. You know, just we could probably remember who was here, remember what we looked like. There's just lots of things we could share. But it would be fascinating to realize how much it was also still individual. Because even on this level, we can only come so close. And these are, again, subtle points, because each of us is still identified with the individuality of which all of the subconscious is the result. The person that all of this experience has created has brought us right to this focus. We are, it's really scary, we are the apex of incarnations of effort. It's really depressing, but we are. We've worked really hard to get here. And so that many different perspectives still filters everything that we see. We're talking about men and women. You start with the male or female gender, then you start with the educational and the cultural background and the this and the this. You have a thousand things. But nonetheless, if we're conscious, those subconscious influences, this is the battleground between these two forces, still we can relate to each other. We're not loony if we can be in this particular thing. But the conscious level is usually not enough to actually bring unity between people. And this is where people try. They try hard, you know, to make connections. But you can only make a connection up to a certain point if it's only a conscious mind connection, because there's still too much that's unique that doesn't allow you. Now when you get to the superconscious, where you're working with, and this is a picture if you want to, just a little triangle like this. This is where we are now. We are actually, this human self that we live in is the most contracted aspect of ourselves. We actually expand literally out to infinity. Okay? But I'll use the fingers of my hand as a way to say this. The ego self lives here. But where does this ego self come from? What animates us? Why were we born? What is the energy that we have in us? Why do we long for happiness? What makes us weep? Why do we love our children? You have all those questions. Because the answer to those actually goes deeper, higher, however you want to say it, into another dimension of reality than just what we perceive from the ego. And from here, it looks like that we're all separate and we have all these gaps that we have to overcome. And if you love someone, if you have sexual union with someone, if you have children that you can embrace, and we have all these ways of trying to bridge that gap, don't we? And in our society, they tell us that sexual union being what they tell you is the apex of love these days. People try, you know, just really hard, squishing their bodies together to somehow overcome that gap. But people discover that even, you know, perfect sexual union doesn't really overcome that gap, and you still find yourself not quite with a shared reality. So now what people do is they seek another partner. You know, it's just like because we're so crazy. But what we really have to do is we have to recognize that there is yet another dimension of ourselves, and that's the superconscious level, and that's what's pulling us. That's why we're not content. You know, sometimes we just think, why can't I just relax? You know, but if you just relax, and there's even whole psychological things just telling you just give in to all of these impulses and you'll feel much better. And you do for, you know, an hour, Because if you take away the, if you cease to strive, you know, you can feel relaxed, but you never feel happy. The libertine is never happy. The undisciplined person is never happy. The pure sensualist is never happy. And this goes back to those first chapters of Education for Life. Let's not talk about theory. Let's actually look around and see what people look like. You know, you meet the man or the woman who's just lived a life of unbridled sensuality, and, you know, they don't look good very long. They can look pretty nice when they're, you know, 17 and 19, but they get start pushing 30, they begin to look pretty bad. And you begin to sort of see the effect of that way of living, because it doesn't work. You see, the people who have focused themselves on expanding their reality and discipline their lives and made something of it, they don't have to follow a conventional course. But in one way or another, they've responded to this tension by expanding their awareness and by learning to relate to a bigger reality, whatever that reality might be. You can be a solitary musician. You can be a poet. You can be a scientist in your lab. You don't have to be a big social person, but you're pushing upward. On the level of superconsciousness, all the divergent seeming separateness of things, you find it suddenly, it comes together. And you realize that everything emanates from the same source. Just like holding up the fingers of the hand. From here, you can't believe it. But when you go deeper into your own self, you follow your own track, you discover that there's a point at which the origin point of my own consciousness is the same as everyone else's origin point. And that, from the level of superconsciousness, that union that we're seeking. And the word yoga, which is now understood to mean mostly yoga postures, actually means union. And it means union on a much higher level than, I mean, yoga postures integrate the physical body, they can integrate the feelings with the body, they can do lots of good things. But real yoga is when you win this battle between the conscious and the superconscious and you unify yourself with your own source. What is meditation? Meditation is using the willpower that's present in the conscious mind to go into superconscious. And the reason meditation is difficult is because when we stop distracting ourselves and just sit on that battleground of consciousness, then the subconscious just puts up everything it can and tries to grab the marble and just pull it down, right? And energy is required, and technique is required, to push your energy instead of into subconscious, into superconsciousness. But when you do begin to experience this, meditation is, I have to explain this thing. Meditation is the technique that enables you to do this. But even when you just try to meditate, and you may even think that your meditation is not fruitful, you have begun to add energy. You've begun to reorient your consciousness. So instead of just living all the time allowing the subconscious to rule, you start actually trying to develop a channel toward the superconscious. And you will discover that even a little bit of meditation practice begins to change everything.
I have a question about seated meditation and relation to, I was having a conversation with Joey. He practices capoeira, which is a Brazilian martial art.
Uh-huh.
And it's really a nice martial art because, you know, the masters were in from Brazil and they said, when both people walk away, there's a winner.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a play, it's a game. You say, you don't fight the other person, you play with them. You get as close as you can without hitting. But anyway, the point is, when you watch this group, to me, what I was watching was complete presence in everybody. You really have to be present. So I was telling him, like, this is a meditation, and now I'm asking you, does that seem accurate to you? To say that when you're in that, is that...
Well, the English is an inadequate language to explain this. It's not meditation in the sense of it's not dhyana, it's not dharana, it's not any of the stages of Patanjali which require complete stillness in the absence of physical movement.
Okay.
Is it meditative? Yes. Is it moving toward true maturity? Absolutely, because in order to do that well, he has to be conscious of the realities of everyone around him, doesn't he?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what martial arts is. You have to be conscious of yourself, and you have to be conscious of other people's realities.
Sure.
Because you use their energy, and if you're not aware of their energy, you can't do it. So it's moving you towards superconscious because it's moving you out of a reality that's only your own into a shared reality, and then you're, in martial arts, the appropriate response to it. That's why you can get to these places from many different angles. A person who does martial arts and also knows how completely independently in his own self to lift his consciousness to a higher level is going to be a much better martial artist. But he can get to it by those physical movements because the concentration has to be there. I mean, they concentrate at different places. But it's not exactly the same. If a martial artist...
I guess the question was sometimes you look at certain things and say, well, you can make anything a meditation almost. So,
well, you can.
Or be in a meditative, I guess.
But there is, yes.
And I have a daily meditation seated practice, so I'm not taking away from that value.
Yeah.
I was just curious of the...
Well, see, what I... What
for
I'm,
some people who say, this is my meditation.
You know, what I resist in this is... You know, meditation... Self-realization is something quite different than being a skilled martial artist. Or... So people have a desire... They have a desire not to have to fight so much. They just say, well, this is my meditation practice. You know, I don't really have to do a seated meditation practice too because this is my meditation. So it's not that it's not true, but there's often motive in people trying to say that.
Sure.
And so I resist the motive rather than the fact because Kriya Yoga, meditation that actually raises you into full super consciousness is something very different than meditative this, meditative that, meditative this. But all of those things are great practices because the more you can practice at all times, anything that you can do that's going to lift yourself toward a greater sense of joined reality, toward true maturity, to use EFL terms, to super consciousness, to use these words, to God realization, it's all the same way. It's all Sanatana Dharma.
So, just for clarification,
sure.
So anything that's focused elevates the levels of consciousness, anything that's purely focused, yeah?
Yeah, and it's all, okay, a very, very good word in all of this, which is a word that Swami uses all the time, is the word directional, okay? We tend to think of it as an either or, that's not at all true. Wherever I'm standing, if I want to go to Paris, I have to get to Paris from here. And I can't just get to Paris. I have to take a step. So wherever I'm standing, I can get to Paris if I just move in that direction. And so you might say that any step toward Paris is going to Paris. So anything that moves you in this direction is directional. And the other two words that we use in this sense, some activities are expansive for our consciousness, and some activities are contractive. Our consciousness. But also, expansive and contractive depends on where you're standing. If your drunken uncle gets off his, you know, puts down his bottle and gets off the couch and goes to law school to become a millionaire, that is an expansive act for him. If Mahatma Gandhi gave up the fight for freeing India and decided that he could make so much money as a lawyer because he's world famous now, that would be a contractive act. So, specifically when we work with the children, at all times we're always asking ourselves, for that child in that moment, what is expansive? You know, some children actually, it's expansive for them to assert their rights because they might be too frightened to exert their rights. And for them to stay in that fear is actually contractive. So sometimes when certain children fight back, the whole school cheers because it's not about being nice. It's about extricating yourself from your subconscious, feeling the pull toward a greater awareness and responding to it. You see, it's very subtle.
That distinction comes from the awareness or the whole idea of where you are in subconscious, right? Because if there's a different perception of what reality is, then the expansive and contractive would be different per individual.
I mean the person themselves, how they would perceive it.
Yeah,
and that's why we're not always the best judge of the right directions for us to go either. Because we tend to be prejudiced in favor of the familiar. And often we literally can't imagine another reality. Thus the need, if you come right down to it, for a guru. But there's lots of stages in between. It's like, how do I know who I am? I've been this one for so long, I don't even know. Just small personal examples. My family, my lovely Jewish family, my brother was the Texas state, we lived in Texas, he was the Texas state debate champion in both his junior and senior years of high school. I was no sloucher at the sport myself, although I didn't like it as much as he did. In our family, debate was conversation. I didn't know that. I didn't understand the difference between conversation and debate. In my house, this is how it went. You got your turn, you with all your strength, you laid out your absolute best arguments, and then you would sit back, and then the next person would lay out theirs and try to take your arguments down. I was 50 years old before I understood that that was not conversation. I and my dear husband for many years would try to say to me, that kind of stops the conversation when the first thing you do is with all your strength lay out your best arguments. And I was just like so bewildered, like, why don't they just take their turn, you know? Because I just didn't know. I really didn't know. And I mean, looking back, people tried to tell me over and over and over again, but that's what I grew up in. And that, so you need friends, you need teachers, you need impartial observers who are wise that you can trust. That's where we have community. Because you go out in community and you keep doing what you think is going to work, and it keeps, like, you know, hitting you like a wet fish in the head. And then if you're at all willing to listen, it'll cross your mind that maybe they're not all wrong. Maybe I'm not relating to reality. And this, of course, is what we try to tell the children. And it's a slow process because they're children in addition to everything else. And they have these really deep-seated inclinations. And we try to understand what are their present inclinations and what will be directionally expansive for them. And we have to help them on the field of battle. The Bhagavad Gita takes place on the field of battle. And the field is called Kurukshetra. So when we actually Kurukshetra, this is the conscious mind is the battle of Kurukshetra. That's where the Bhagavad Gita takes place. So the children are always, you know, here, and we're trying to help them understand, one, that this battle is taking place, and two, to give them the right weapons to actually fight against these inclinations and move toward this. This is why we teach them to meditate and so on. So when we're meditating, to just come back to that, what we're doing is we're trying to direct our energy. I'm going to just give you one more. I don't have time to do much more. Is there any more question about where we are here? This is all laying groundwork, friends. We have four more classes. We can really get this really worked out. Okay. I'm going to make
just a quick question. Sure. Or more of a distinction.
Uh-huh.
I'm just thinking about this. So the depiction between the expansive and the contractive,
right.
I was thinking about it now because the question I asked, it's more based upon, you know, like the deity, I guess. So what would be deemed more
expansive?
Yeah, in line with.
What's deemed more expansive is for you to relate, to have greater awareness and relate to a reality bigger than the one that you have at the present. You know, Gandhi was relating to the destiny of his whole nation. If he tried to become a rich man at that point, that would be, he would be going backwards. The drunk uncle is not willing to put out the energy even to pay his own way. So for him to suddenly be willing to concentrate enough to get rich, he's going to be disciplining himself in the forward-moving direction. So it just depends entirely where you're standing, which is the extraordinary beauty of this. However, it is directional towards somewhere. And this is, again, in the EFL book where Swamiji talks about that. People say everything is relative, and then they blame Einstein. No, no. Einstein said everything is relative to the speed of light. There was a fixed point that everything is referring to. Everything is relative to the state of bliss. And everything moves toward that state of bliss. There is it's Satchitananda, which I said last week. And now this isn't just an opinion, and this isn't just a convenient idea. This is a fact, if you pay attention. Now, however you call this, expanding awareness. If you think about it, everything is relative to my greater and greater awareness, because greater awareness ultimately leads to greater bliss. But wherever you're standing, because see, we think of it like this. We always think of it in a straight line. People are here, someone else is here, someone is here, someone is here. And this is how our whole society is set up. This child has a D, this child has an A, this child is behind, this child is ahead, these children want to be ahead. That's why we don't give grades. As soon as we grade the papers, every child wants to know what every other child did. And learning stops. Becomes pure measurement against each other. You know, every once in a while they experiment with giving grades. I've been told by the teachers it instantly destroys the learning environment. Because the only thing that matters, truth is not linear. Because we're all different. If this man is destined to be a brilliant musician, he's going to have a very different energy than this man over here who's going to be a wonderful mechanic. Or this one who's going to be a farmer. Or this lady over here who's just going to be a mother. She's not going to have any big career in her life. But forward for each of these people depends on expanding their awareness, moving into a greater maturity to relate to other realities. The truth is in the center, you see. Truth is not at the end of the line. It's not a line like this. Truth is in the center, and we all move toward it. So what happens is, if you're to the north, your instructions, you have to go south. If you're to the south, you have to go north. These people meet each other and they get into a big fight. Because it's directional toward the state of perfect bliss in the middle. You know, that's why it gets very subtle. Like, some people are born to be soldiers. Because the discipline of being a soldier, of sacrificing your life for a cause you believe in, is expansive for that person. Some people are born to be narrow-minded, fundamentalist Christians. I met this man that was interviewing on the radio. He'd been a drug addict on the street, and he became a Christian. And then he tried to put me in a very difficult position on the radio. But I didn't want to take him away from being a Christian. He needed the most narrow-minded, fanatical Christianity that was possible, because otherwise he was a drug addict on the street. But you know, I don't need that. For me, it's very contractive to think like that. I'm ready to go for the whole universe. But for him to move toward the center, that's what he needed. Because it's relative to the state of bliss, depending on what level of consciousness they're on and where they're going. Our society now, our educational system, this goes into another aspect of it, is all about competition and reward.
Can I ask something about that?
I just need to say one last thing. If you have a child who's idealistic or inclusive in his thinking, you know, it's about punishment and external reward. And it just passes by children for whom this game is like they've long gone past this game. And there's just nothing in it for them. So sometimes the best students are the ones who are treated the worst in the system they have. Yes.
You'll probably get to it eventually, but I just wanted you to touch on college and college from this system, because it's all the grades again.
Well, it's exactly the same. Everything is geared for people who are motivated by external reward. And some people need to be motivated by external reward. We're working with our children. If they do need external rewards, we try to give them appropriate external rewards rather than "I'm up on you" external rewards. And some children really, really want this. And not everybody, you know, we have to just work with everybody as we can. This is the light, medium, heavy that comes out. Some people will only respond to the threat of punishment. Some will only respond to self-interest. Some will respond to idealism. And some will respond to divinity. And there's all four. If you take an idealistic child and threaten to punish him, he just feels demeaned by that. You know, I would have done it anyway. If you take an idealistic child and promise him an A, or as my friend who was raised by nuns, bigger house in heaven if he's good. You know, he was so delighted when the nun said that, because then he didn't have to be good ever after. Because he didn't really care about the size of his house in heaven, and it just relieved him of all that responsibility. But you know, it's just ridiculous. But it's all directional. Right? Okay, questions or thoughts about that?
So that I was just wondering, college seems pretty negative
college is,
in that sense,
college is
you know?
The worst of all, if you want my opinion.
That's
but
what
I'm a dropout.
I'm asking, yeah.
Nobody ever talks to me about college unless they're ready to drop out. I just tell them when they come to me, don't talk to me about college. Your mother will
That's
get really upset with me. Don't talk to me. No, I dropped out of college because for me there was nothing in it. Because I didn't have a profession that required college. If you know, I didn't have an ambition that needed college. And it was just
so it could potentially be positive if
you love learning. Yeah. You know, everything is directional. You cannot say that anything is good or bad. It's only not good for you if it's contractive from where you are in the circle. It's good for you if it's expansive. When you see people who get themselves organized and love to learn and are in college and are making good grades, you know, it can be fabulous for them because it becomes the means through which they expand their awareness. That's why we teach the children and we ask them to learn and we make them do things because we can't just sort of sit there and say, expand your consciousness. Overcome your subconscious inclinations. That's why we get married and have children and, you know, get involved in all this messy stuff. Because it puts us in the right framework. It puts us on the battlefield of Kurukshetra between our subconscious and our superconscious. Am I really going to expand beyond my subconscious habits and make harmony in this household? You know, be serviceful to the people that God has given me responsibility for, succeed in my job, fulfill my creative potential, or am I just going to sit here and eat bonbons? You know? And we all just want to sometimes just sit there and eat bonbons, but it doesn't really work. The problem with it is it doesn't work. It's very practical. This is education for life, you see. It's not a theory. What happens if you just sit there and eat bonbons? You might get on reality television eventually. But that's not really success. You see, it doesn't work. So we have to teach the children, we have to teach ourselves, because we're just children in big bodies, with different rules. But we have to teach them what works. And this is expansive versus contraction. You think of it like this, it's like you're expanding into more and more of the circle, instead of just being on the edge, you're embracing the whole, each other direction. I was going to, and I probably don't have time. I don't have time. So, I will start next week. Oh, but you just get this. I will just put this up and then I'll explain it in more detail. This is the picture of the meditation. This is the conscious level where we normally live. And all our senses are awake and we're touching, we're feeling, we're talking, we're walking, we're listening, we're doing things. We're awake. We think of it like this, that here's subconscious, here's conscious, here's superconscious. That we always think linear, but linear is not where it happens. The conscious level here, we reach this junction point. And when we're going to sleep, which you know all of us will do later this evening, we will roll back from the conscious level. You'll turn off the television if you were watching it, you'll close your book, you'll turn off the lights, you'll put your body down, you may put earplugs in, you'll close your eyes. You roll back all conscious input. And then you put out less and less energy and you fall into the subconscious state. If you have insomnia, or if you have anxiety, you roll back to this point, but all of a sudden your mind gets really agitated and you have too much energy to fall into the subconscious state. When you meditate, you do pretty much exactly the same thing. You sit still, you close your eyes, you turn off all the input, but instead of putting out less and less energy, you take all the energy that you would have been spending in all of this dynamic activity, and you simply focus it. Well, not simply, but yes, yeah, simply, but not easily. You simply focus it, and then you rise into superconsciousness. And the reason why, often, instead of rising into superconsciousness, we either just roll back into the conscious mind, or sometimes we fall asleep, is because we're so accustomed, once we stop stimulating the conscious mind, we're accustomed to falling asleep. We're not accustomed to going to the other possibility when you're outside of the conscious mind. You see. And when you learn to do this at will, and then you can bring this energy back into your conscious life, you have a tremendous, tremendous resource available to you. And even the tiniest effort to go this way just opens up this huge channel of intuition and creativity that you can then use in this part of your life. Okay? And then sometimes you're in super consciousness and you let your energy drop, and all of a sudden you're meditating like this. You know, that you're super conscious and then you let your energy fall, and then you fall into subconscious. The reason we meditate sitting up and lying down, instead of lying down, even in a more relaxed level down, is because the association between lying down and, you know, and that is just too great. You go into subconscious, it's too easy. Okay. Any questions about that? Because we've hit the end of our talk for this evening. Next week what we'll do is I will teach you a little more, we'll start, and when we meditate at the beginning, I'll teach you a little more specific about what to do when you're meditating. And with this, I just wanted to get this image in your mind before we meet next Monday, so that we'll know what we're doing here. Rolling everything back, but at this point we become very energetic. And the whole trick of meditation, and the reason it's so difficult, is we are not accustomed to being very energetic unless we are also acting in an outward way. But however, many of you I know have strong, you know, inner life, mental life at least, if not an inner spiritual, emotional life, and so on. So if you have a strong mental life, you're accustomed to directing a lot of energy only through your mind, without physical parts. You know, none of us are super athletes or that kind of, you know, people who live only through their body. You hear the tennis stars on the radio, and they're just all like way in their body, or just something else. But a more intellectual person understands non-physical energy. And then we just have to raise it into non-mental energy, which is what I'll start talking about next week. And that, because we start using the heart. See, we're getting very mental. But now when we bring the heart into it, the combination of the mind and the heart is what brings us into superconsciousness. Okay, questions or thoughts before we close up for the night?
Yeah, I can certainly go, but I'll wait till next week.
Okay. We can start right in next week. Okay? I mean, we can start right from the beginning with whatever you have to ask. And we can, you know, we'll take as much time as we need. Okay? You can play some with meditating if you want to this week. Go right ahead, but I'll give you more grounding in it. We're sort of doing a whole bunch of stuff at the same time.
Is that how I asked if you were going to explain something like underneath the meditation in the beginning?
Yeah.
Is that kind of
this
what
is the beginning
were?
Of it?
Okay.
There's more.
Yeah.
The relationship between the breath, between the breath and meditation and your state of mind, how the feelings of the heart play into it, and then more about why the subconscious has such a strong hold on us. Are all the other elements that we need to talk about. Because when we understand why the subconscious pulls us back so much of the time, it gives us tools for how to fight against that.
What about the very simple aspects of it, like the actual, the image of a mountain and the image, the colors and that stuff? That
well,
seems like an element.
We can get there.
Okay.
It just all takes time.
Cool.
We're just trying to do a lot at the same time here. So let's just breathe out and be patient. All right. I'm going to try to get this posted so